paragraph 669, Hegel famously says, "The wounds of the spirit heal and leave no scars behind. The deed is not imperishable. It is taken back by spirit into itself. And the aspect of individuality present in it, whether an intention or an existent negativity and limitation, straightaway vanishes." That's what he takes to be the logic of forgiveness. The first moment that I want to just mention here, and I'll come back to it next week, is where he says, the aspect of individuality present in it, whether an intention or as an existent negativity and limitation, straightaway vanishes. He is claiming there that individuality as such, whether of nature, desire, act, whatever that notion of individuality refers to, does not necessarily count against a universal claim or against universality itself, that is, our being together as spiritual creatures. Hence, the notion of forgiveness is a forgiving of individuality itself, and it's for this reason that it's going to play a role in our notion of historical memory, the so-called slaughter bench of history. Because the claim here is, or the hint of a claim, which I'll have to flesh out next week, is that there is, in looking over the past, a sieving of the universal content out of the crazy individual histories from which it grew and arose. Because individuality, negativity, falsity are the origin and hence belong to the true and the universal, then they are necessary for it. Hence, whatever universality is, arises only through what is not universal, and hence we have to forgive that moment of individuality, negativity, falseness, or there will be no universality at all, which is to say, no history at all. History, when I get there next week, is simply the standpoint of forgiveness. Well, what does forgiveness mean concretely? The naturalist would say that it means merely an act of forgetting. But what kind of forgetting? I'm thinking of Nietzsche's act of forgetting, right? Do we really forget the injuries done to us? Of course not. If someone tragically shoots off my big toe, I am not likely to forget it. And therefore, whatever forgiveness means, it cannot mean forgiving, because every time I take my shoe off, there's a missing toe, right? There's a limit here. And we're not going to play the game. I'm not taking my shoes or socks off, so don't even think about it. So if it's not that, then what is going on? in a certain way and at a certain level, we can neither forgive nor undo, right? The broken mold is broken. You can glue it, but it has glue lines. What it is, I want to claim, is not identifying you with your action. That is, it depends upon what I call, in the analytic of action, the duality of action between intention and expression. Remember I said that every action occurs in at least two registers. There is the deed done, and what is expressed by, of you, by doing that deed. What forgiveness does is reorient, redetermine the expressive dimension of the deed. And it does so by not tying you to that deed, but freeing you from full responsibility for it as a perpetual mark of who you are, and therefore what your identity is for me and for yourself. Obviously, you can be forgiven, but unless you forgive yourself, it won't work. I free you of thinking of that action as constituted of who you are in your relationship to me and all others. Forgiveness is, if this is right, the detaching of the individual from the action. After all, the action stays in the past, but the individual continues into the future. Arendt says that we can only punish what we can forgive. And her thought here is that either punishment is part of the process of a re-entry into community, or it is nothing but vengeance. The idea of punishment, and hence the crazy Hegelian idea that the criminal deserves to be punished, it's a version of the criminal deserves the possibility of confession. The idea of punishment is hence the idea that we have a process of finding ways of acknowledging that someone has transgressed, and yet they are not confined or defined by that act. Can all actions be forgiven? Hegel has a complicated view of this. But at its simplest moral level, he says, absolutely not. Despite what he says here about all wounds can heal, in the philosophy of right, he says, we cannot forgive murder. And the reason we cannot forgive murder is because the one whose life was taken away isn't there to do the forgiving. And who are we to forgive for them? Analogously, Arendt says that we cannot forgive genocide. Bizarrely, but I find nonetheless not inconsequentially. For both Hegel and Arendt, the death penalty is not a punishment. The death penalty is what we do when punishment is impossible. It is our confession that we have nowhere to go and no future with this person. So that the death penalty is not a way of enacting our sovereignty, but on the contrary, it's our acknowledgement of the impossibility of sovereignty. Which is why whatever else Derrida did in his lectures on the death penalty, they were simply confused. I mean, they were bad in all sorts of ways. But about, they were just even worse than that, though. He really does not understand the death penalty or what it means to get rid of it. I'll come back to the fact. So this is, both of them say, in terms of, let's call it, everyday morality, kind of stuff that deals with murder and genocide, not everything can be forgiven. They both will say something slightly different when they think about the meaning of history. Come back to that next week. But I mean, all right, let me just give a hint of the fall. If it's true that in thinking about the meaning of freedom and liberty for us Americans today, that is why we prize freedom and liberty, I would argue that it is necessary for us to think of it in terms of the history of slavery. That we cannot conceive of the meaning of freedom without thinking of that movement of slavery and the emancipation of slavery as constitutive of the idea of freedom for us. But that means that in the actual texture of our idea of what freedom is and freedom means, we have a memory of that event. We have, in some sense, allowed it in. And it's thinking of what it means to allow it in some sense, that is the problem of absolute knowledge. I'll come back to that next time. But so there's a different register here in thinking about being in a particular situation and faced with a particular form of trespass or transgression, and the standpoint of history, which is, after all, what? Standpoint of judging consciousness? Arendt says that trespassing is an everyday occurrence. What I'm now claiming is that all significant action is a matter of transgression. And if that is true, if every single significant human action is a form of trespass and transgression, then every single judgment of an action that will allow that action to count as a contribution to our life together is categorically an act of forgiveness. So, confession. I've already argued that every act, every significant action is an act of confession. That every time we act, we have to be confessing the necessity and inevitability of our evil, which is our individuality, because that's what it means to say every act is transgressive. Every significant act bears within it a moment of negativity. And therefore, every single significant human action at the level of transgression is a misrecognition. That is, a non-recognition of the other. What we confess, when we confess, is that. So what we confess in recognizing, confession is the recognition of misrecognition. That's what we're confessing. Analogously, every judgment, and I want to be clear, every judgment is going to be a judgment of right or wrong. Right? There's no avoiding determining whether the action was right or wrong, productive, unproductive, destructive or undestructive, or the like. But nonetheless, even to get to this point, to be able to do the work of judgment, we have to already have forgiven the other the trespass and allowed the possibility of that action contributing or failing to contribute to the meaning of our life together. Hence, the thought is that action always in a community of conscientious agents is confession, and judgment always in a community of conscientious agents is an act of forgiveness. Because, and again the same thing that I said above, because in judging we are beginning with the premise, right? What's forgiven is transgression. That's the opening gambit, that we always begin by having gone too far, gone further than has been licensed or recognized or legitimated by our society, community, culture, or indeed just our life together, you and me. Now, in saying this, therefore, I am arguing that the reason why, therefore, recognition is never reciprocal recognition is because recognition is always a sign or an aspect of a moment of misrecognition. That recognition is not some, oh yeah, we recognize, that's back to the hippie community. That's your model of pure recognition or mutual recognition, and that's a community of non-action. So Hegel's thought is that the structure is a structure of recognition and misrecognition, and that what we confess in each case and what we forgive in each case is our finitude. and the cost and weight of that. Which is to say, we forgive one another for being human. And therefore, we forgive the human race. Hegel does not provide a theodicy. Nor, however, does he generate a dualism or Manichaeanism. Rather, he seeks to find the space within our understanding of ourselves as rational agents for the fact of the inevitability of evil as part of the web and weave of human life together. And that, again, is because evil is nothing but the power of freedom and is always in need of acknowledgement. When I confess and when you forgive me, I can stop. In some sense, we've reached the end of the book. There's no necessity for going any further. There is, but whatever it is, it's not obvious. There is now no obvious externality, and there is now no obvious something that is going to push this story forward. The scene of mutual recognition. So, Comte, I think, rightly says that the notion of forgiveness is like the logic of the gift. And it's like the logic of the gift. Because it always arrives unexpectedly, as if from the future, and it is drawn from depleted reserves of one who has nothing left to give. That is, the act of forgiveness speaks to a moment, even a moment that occurs here in the phonology, where there is nothing left between these two but their mutual emptiness. I'm evil, and you're a beautiful soul. Which is to say, we've both been reduced to a form of emptiness. So this moment is not founded on a surplus, on a grand foundation. Rather, it is the acknowledgement of a founding or grounding of the self in a nothingness and emptiness. And the it takes, indeed, everything up to this moment has been history pressing itself forward. I guess if you are a crazy Benjaminian, you might say this is a moment of the messianic ceasing of action. Moment when the negative no longer determines, but it's out of that negative itself that history can happen. never find my place. So Hegel says, paragraph 672, I have another series of arguments I want to run. I know why. Hegel says, paragraph 672, again, another offensive passage, the reconciling yea, in which the two I's let go their antithetical existence. Notice, it's two yeas, two affirmations, not negations, not determinate negations. And what is let go of is simply our antithetical existence. What is this letting go? It is the existence of the I. We finally be able, we've been saying, I think. We haven't got the I am yet. This is the longest cogito possible. Well, I think that's what it is. I think it's an expanded cogito. That's how I think the argument works. It's I think, sense certainty. And then here's where they say, yay, I am. Because you have to actualize your essence, right? To say you are and you're an historical being, dependent, absolutely dependent on the other, etc., etc. So, is the existence of the I which has expanded into a duality and thereby remains identical with itself, because it's acknowledgement of absolute dependence and absolute independence. And in its complete externalization, this will become in the chapter on religion, kenosis, God emptying himself out in the incarnation, which is to say the act, this is an act, confession and forgiveness are both radical acts of self-dispossession. Right? So it's a logic of possession through and only through self-dispossession. That was the difficulty that acting consciousness had to learn, right, when she confessed. She thought she had self-dispossessed enough, right? I confessed. You're not empty enough, honey. It's much worse than you think. Complete, in its complete externalization and opposite, possesses the certainty of itself. It is God manifested in the midst of those who know themselves in the form of pure knowledge. So, in being absolutely dependent on you, I nonetheless remain, indeed become for the first time, an autonomous self, so the grounding of autonomy in heteronomy, and furthermore, I do not lose anything thereby. So, it is perfectly true that both confession and forgiveness are terms with a theological origin. My reading of this entire chapter, which clearly is a working through Kantian moral philosophy and romantic moral philosophy and romantic aesthetics, is the goal is to show why that theological vocabulary is unintelligible in its theological setting and requires a radical secularization. That is, I take it that what Hegel is doing here, and I'll say more about this as we carry on into religion, is he's tapping what he sees as the great insight of Christianity, namely the forgiveness of original sin, And his argument is going to be, it better not be of the day of judgment. It better be right here and now, and it better already have happened. Well, how can we think that this must be the right way to go? Well, think about Descartes again. And think about how bizarre it is. I mean, what is it that makes Descartes think in the third meditation that unless there is a God, then he is finally and forever trapped in his own solipsistic consciousness? So up until the third meditation, you might say, Descartes is like a beautiful soul. And then he gives an argument. The famous argument from perfection. What is the argument from perfection? It's an argument of an acknowledgement of absolute dependence. That's what the third meditation is existentially about. Right? It is the discovery that if I am finite and imperfect, then I cannot be self-grounding. And if I cannot be self-grounding, that is, if I cannot assure myself of my place in the world all by myself, then I must be dependent on another. that Levinas gets half right. And he kind of sees that something like this is going on. So that the right way of reading the third meditation is as a meditation on the meaning of finitude. Right? That's why it's powerful. What is ludicrous about it is that Descartes says, I'm dependent, and never thinks to ask anything of a serving girl who's feeding his breakfast. That is, he assumes that his dependence will be dignified if he's dependent on a god rather than another human being. But all he is doing, right, is thinking through this experience of absolute dependence. What Hegel shows in gruesome detail is that we're dependent on one another, on community, and on history. Those three things. And that therefore there is no space for a God, and that dependence is something that the right relationship to it is one of recognizing or acknowledging it, just like independence can only be performed. And is performed again, what? With the act of forgiveness, which is the act in which I performatively show my independence by letting the others dependent on me not become a debt to me. That's the genius of forgiveness. I don't ask for a payment. I don't rub it in and say, oh, you're going to be dependent. I'm going to get in there. Come on, you'll be my slave. No, it's the end of slavery. That's why it gets rid of the Nietzschean logic of guilt and debt. It realizes, of course, that guilt and debt arise out of a structure of mutual dependencies, and therefore we are indebted to one another, but that would become intolerable, right? Namely, a structure of vengeance, unless we went through this logic.
So what keeps forgiveness from being transgressive? And insofar as it's an act, insofar as it's also a confession of my complicity
right.
with the other. Why does it not take on the same character of this revolution?
It can. Nothing is going to guarantee that it works out right. The reason that it works when it does is for exactly the reason I just said. That is, so this is my, you know, this is why Derrida is wrong about the gift. It cannot be impossible to receive the gift, right? It's simply that the possibility is not part of a logic of exchange. That's fine. That's what I'm saying. It's not a debt structure. But that depends on us recognizing that. Of course, your point is perfectly right. If I forgive you, then under bad circumstances, you know, Oxy comes in, her essay is a month overdue. I forgive you. Doesn't help, right? Feels terrible. Nothing can make it work. But the logic of it is the possibility of transcending the debt relationship and a relationship of exchange. But it has to be. That's why he says it's two spontaneities. It's yay, yay, right? That is a possibility. And I here said, by saying it belongs to every action, I'm saying we're not done with it. It's not like one moment. I'm suggesting that that's required of us all the time. So I do have a kind of demanding hyperbole here of what's required of us as conscientious agents. That is a perpetual work of forgiving and confessing.
Wouldn't it be kind of absolute task then? Would this to any extraction in particular, like by making the severance, the cut it off, like you're interested in, by really radically cut it off, then what am I forgiven? You know, there's a point, but there has to be a limit that maintains itself in order for this whole circuit to keep going.
We'll never know what it is.
But that's just to say it's a miracle.
Yeah.
It's, I mean,
No. Well, it's not a miracle because we can do it. It's just a performance. It has the logic of a miracle in the sense that it's an interruption into the structure of natural causality. But every free action was always that. And the only reason that we think of it as truly miraculous is because we're thinking of the logic of cause and effect. But I'm not talking about the logic of cause and effect. I'm talking about the logic of vengeance. And I'm saying we can be released from that. Easily, as it so happens. Sometimes. Impossibly. Sometimes. And the answer is there's no philosophical infinite task. We've recognized the possibility of human action. That's all that's required philosophically. Of course, in objective spirit, in history, it just goes on and on. History does. Of course people have to keep doing whatever we do to be human. So is eating. It doesn't mean it's infinite task like reaching the absolute. The absolute is here and now. There's no further thing we have to do to find it. It's just that we're temporal creatures, so we have to keep working. That's all. It's not an infinite task. It's only, it's a repetitious task, not an infinite task of approaching something asymptotically. No, we're there, right here and now. And every right here and now. Yeah.
Reconciling what you just said with the build-up, which is the idea that forgiveness somehow is kind of
become an eruption. Because it seems to me that if I say I forgive you, I don't know when I say it if it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only in the working out of our subsequent lives together that it becomes true or not. It's another way in which it's another action that's subject to retrospective negotiation, just like every other action we've seen.
Yep.
It's before. But if that's true, then what's important, then what makes it erupt? Then how, I mean, at the time, in a sense, it's nothing.
It's not vengeance is what it is. That's what makes it unpredictable. It's not earned or deserved. I mean, it's all those things that make it an eruption. It allows for a beginning because it allows our history together perhaps to have a new beginning.
But as an eruption is only represented. Sense. Like the example you gave of let's go
fetch. No, it's a chance that can be lost. It does erupt, but it erupts as a chance and a risk. It's not a guarantee, it's not a certainty, it's none of that. But it does do all the logical stuff. Break us out of the natural cycle and turns away from revenge. It does all sorts of stuff, but doing that can't be done in a second. But doing this is a condition for whatever would be that novelty. Right? So the point you're making is right, but it's like it's a Wittgenstein grammatical point. Right? You can't be in love for just a half a second. Well, you can't be forgiven in a second either. Although you have that. You have to be forgiven at 1 second. Because it has to be done. There has to be the determination, the eruption, the spontaneity. Right? Yeah, awesome.
How far is tolerance a form of indifference? Because it appears that tolerance of either of an action doesn't really fit into this picture at all, and it appears the only other way would be the hard heart.
Tolerance, I take to be a truly, purely political concept. And it's about creating certain types of political spaces, namely for things that we have the power. You can't tolerate what you can't stop. So you can only technically tolerate something if you're in the position to stamp it out. And yet you realize that the grounds for stamping it out would be, shall we say, to close off human possibilities in a way that seems unnecessary because apart from my sensibility, there is no harm done. So I think tolerance would be a very kind of complicated political negotiation about the kind of spaces we want in, I don't believe in pluralism, but let's say in a complex society. Yeah?
To whatever extent it helps me, would I be quite often thinking about our forgiveness in the sense as, say, the structure of what Badiou calls the event, where it kind of happens in a second, but then it's, this possibility that either gets picked up in a trace or not, but it's this spontaneous emergence that's not structurally determined by whatever material conditions have to be for it.
Yeah, except that's cruddy ontology. But apart from that, it's fine. No. I mean that. The whole point here is Hegel's trying to break from ontology, right? And that's based on a theory of ontology, right? Hegel's trying to map what we think of idealism. Is to say there is no ontology except through the understanding of the space of human judgment and action. Everything else is just fantasy. Mathematics, I take, is one of the most tempting of fantasies, especially set theory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, if there are unpredictable acts, how do you know whether it's an attitude of the act or of the judgment?
I mentioned that there were, I gave two examples of unforgivable acts, which is to say, It's not ontology. That's all I meant to say. That even the notion of unforgivability is going to be us negotiating that idea of what we can allow back in, right, in certain ways, given everything else that we've already agreed to. Right?
So it just has to do with capacity as well as that?
No, not just capacity, because we've already established all men are equal, all men are free. We've got a whole elaborate ethics and politics here. So when you kill someone, you're certainly doing something to their freedom. When you decide to kill a whole people, right? So the very acts that are at stake here are ones where the presumption of non-forgiveness here is, one thing is, if the person who the injury is against is not around, then how is forgiveness possible? That's the way Hegel and Arendt are. That's not a bad starting place for the unforgivable, if you think there is the unforgivable. If. I simply said they don't buy it. I said nothing about whether or not they're right. What I said is their thoughts are intelligible. But I take it that this is not a dry question. Yeah? There are two different answers to that. One is for criminal actions that we consider below the level of the unforgivable. Right? We have a certain type of, let's say, theory of punishment, rehabilitation, and the like. That's what we're trying to do there. We're trying to find conditions for confession and reentry. Then we also simply have the notion of pardon. And Hegel says it's the notion of pardon that is always going to be the excessive act that any pure theory of law has to have as an acknowledgement of what it is. Otherwise, it will get caught in its own logic. Right? And that's what he argued right in the spirit of Christianity. That law can deal with punishment, but not with pardon. But pardon is the human moment that actually the whole thing turns on. Okay, I guess there are people outside. So we'll do more stuff next week.